folks, it's spoiler in time. And on this episode, we're going to spoil the episode of Firefly called Bushwhacked, episode three of season seven of Game of Thrones, season two, episode six of Preacher, and episode two of season three of Rick and Morty. I'm Tom Merritt. Hey, wait a minute. Are you Brian Brushwood?
Yeah, I am. And for those of you guys confused because you just dropped in, Cord Killers is, of course, the show where we teach you how to watch the stuff when you want, what you want, on whatever device you do. This is where we talk about how we feel about those things. And we're joined by special guests. For example, today from oneofus.net, we have Chris Cox.
It's so great to be here. I just flew in from way north Austin. Holy crap, this is way down here.
Yeah, and boy, are my arms tired. Pretty far south. Yeah, this not going to lie.
This is like a Dorn. I mean, seriously.
Yes. Welcome to Dragonstone. Hey, man, let's jump in and we'll start off with the latest on the summer movie draft.
Now, we're going to have to spend quite a while on the movie draft today, Brian.
Why is that?
Because I'm winning.
Oh, you. By the way, you are the runaway winner and pretty much has settled the Chat Realm League. We have congratulations to Quantum Feline and Toner Boner. Great names, both of you. DTNS is you have no chance of being overtaken. However,
I don't know. Atomic Blonde only brought in $18 million opening weekend, and I spent $6 on it.
All right. But Night Attack and Big and Tall. Night Attack still in second place. Big and Tall.
No, I'm kind of shocked by that.
At our heels. Question, how much more is left in the tank for War of the Planet of the Apes and Spider-Man Homecoming?
And Girls Trip. $65 million out of Girls Trip.
That dude, surprises turned it out to be a pretty good buy on that one. So yeah. I think Girls Trip definitely, if we do hold on to the second place, which we'll know in what, two more weeks, three more weeks, then that will be the single purchase that saved us from number three.
Yeah. Of course, one movie remaining in the draft is The Dark Tower. Comes out August 4th. That is Team Frog Pants, who got a respectable $101 million out of Dunkirk. It still has not quite lifted them past Team Cord Killers out of last place, though.
Dunkirk should have done for them to win. Dunkirk had to be Inception. It had to be a surprise, blow you away, like everyone like, no, you must see Dunkirk. And it doesn't quite sound like it was very, very good.
Are you
but it doesn't
in
sound
international numbers?
No. Domestic
okay.
only.
Domestic only.
Okay. Because yeah. I know Dunkirk is going to do very well internationally.
Oh yeah,
for sure.
Because everybody loves seeing the British kid.
Dude, we reviewed
hammered.
It with a British guy who was just like, now it's finally my moment. I get to talk about something.
I still haven't seen Dunkirk. Have you seen it yet, Tom?
No, I really do want to see it because I this is so nerdy, but I am a fan of The Miracle at Dunkirk. Like ever since I first read about it in high school, I've loved that story of all the little fishing boats going out and saving everyone. Even though I know it's largely mythologized and exaggerated, I just adore that story.
So, okay. So I did go see The Big Sick, which you also still haven't seen. So whether you see The Big Sick or Dunkirk, just let me know and I will make sure that I come equipped to talk about either of those next week.
They're both right. So good.
Sounds good to me. Maybe I'll go sneak out and see one of them tonight.
By the way, if you like Dunkirk, a nice little side film to watch is Their Finest, which is out on Blu-ray, which is about the media department at the British government for making entertainment to make people like, you know, before the war effort. And they make a movie about Dunkirk.
About propagandizing
But with a female lead writer who comes into it who's like, well, we don't have any male writers left because they're all fighting in the war. So really good.
All right. Let's move on to talk about Rick and Morty. I will talk about both episodes one and two, though we have previously talked about episode one when it arrived by surprise on April 1st. I only watched episode two. I didn't rewatch episode one. Did you?
I did. I did rewatch episode one. And man, oh, man, is that a masterful. We've talked about this before. For the story that I've heard is that they didn't do a lot of in
you're trying
universe.
To be Rick there when you're talking.
Let me tell you something, Tom. The story that I heard from Dan Harmon talking about is that they didn't bother to do a lot of in universe building because they didn't expect to keep getting seasons and to be at you know, the beginning of season three, when clearly they have a hit on their hands, and to see them pull out all the stops in that first episode, and to get all the you know, the Council of Ricks is back, the bug people are back, and everything to come together like that was just extraordinary. Now, did you see that
McDonald's sent them a jug of Szechuan sauce?
Yeah, that's right.
They're going to do a live video of them taste testing it again after all these years.
Oh, that's great. they definitely, they put it in like a gun case, and it says McDimension 317 or whatever. It was, the first episode was fantastic. It was great watching it again. It definitely stands up to multiple viewings, which is why I almost feel underqualified to really talk about episode two, because I missed the first viewing of it because of time schedule. So by the time the second one came up, it was the middle of the night. I was just about to go to bed. And I remember most of it, except for how it wrapped up. I love the whole Mad Max aesthetic. I thought angry summer and working out. I didn't think I would find much entertaining about the divorce, but instead by diving into the process of grieving that happens when families, you know, get torn asunder like that, I thought there was a lot more comedy gold in there than I would have expected.
Yeah, no, it's dark comedy gold at points, but it's really good. One of the lines that stuck out to me is Rick early saying, yeah, I can make as many summers as I need. Don't worry about it. And then later, Rick talking, oh, I know you can make as many summers and Mortys as you need. And Rick going, yeah, but you know what? That's an awful lot of trouble. I don't want to go to all that trouble. It's perfect. It's perfect bookends. And there's so many examples like that. It ends up with the robot versions of all three of them playing the game with the mom and then getting the summons to go back into the garage, and the Morty bot starting to fight his programming and not wanting to go back because he wants to be real.
Oh, that's right. He achieves proto sentience in that moment.
And then, of course, they end up overriding him. He goes into the garage, and the three real people come back and are like, "Oh, you're playing. You want to play that stupid game?"
That's right. And then I loved the whole Battle Dome muscle memory arm, like the arm that wanted vengeance on its
because
own.
Because Morty's working out his issues about his dad's divorce, and the arm's working about his issues about being murdered.
Yes. Yes. And Gambling Man is pointing out the fact that they use so many tropes. They use so many tropes to show what a douchebag or what a crappy position Jerry's in, where it's like there's tumbling weeds, leaves, and the wind blows and the chimes tinkle, and then you hear the word loser. I enjoy that very, very much.
Yeah, no, I don't even know what to say about it except watch it and enjoy it. And even if you don't get every reference, you'll find plenty that they're there to entertain you.
And that's one of the weird things is oftentimes the ones that I like the most upon the first viewing become the ones that I'm least interested in. Whereas the ones that, you know, on the seventh viewing, I'm like, this is absolute genius from beginning to end. Everything is set up perfectly. There's an economy of storytelling here.
Comedy show that uses real science fiction. You know what I mean? Even Futurama doesn't really do that.
Well, we've talked about this. It's a bit as though they set out to like send up Doctor Who for sloppy script writing, and along the way just wrote tighter, better scripts than you get from Doctor Who sometimes.
Yeah. Did you guys think it was weird that the world that they went to was just Mad Max? Was that great, right? Like totally fit into the plot, but it was
the exact world,
actually just Mad Max with the gasoline and the cars and
the bit about like blasting gasoline into the engine to give it a boost
there's one point where a guy just goes, I'm all chrome and stuff, or something. He almost sounds like a word for word line from Mad Max Fury Road.
I felt, yes, and you would expect them to build an equally compelling world parallel to that, that's happened in the same thing, but also, there was so much of this episode where there was this kind of eye-rolling wink about, like, we're on another adventure, this one's in Mad Max world, and something about that made me not mind that it was actually in Mad Max world.
Well, because nothing in the main storyline relied on the Mad Max universe at all. Right. Even the one thing that is tangentially part of that universe with the arm is not a thing from Mad Max Fury Road. It's just something that they made up, that Rick made up. And I think that's why it works, because they're like, yeah, that's the background. Fine. We're not gonna overplay that hand, but everything in the background will be that universe, which then sets up the amazing joke when they turn on the electricity and suddenly the Mad Max universe all settles down and becomes couch potatoes.
Yes, exactly. I think it's gonna need a couple more laps for me to love it as much as it probably deserves. But for right now, it was solid sophomore attempt in this season of metaphors.
All right. What's the sixth year of high school? Because we're at the sixth episode of Preacher.
I don't know. You're messing me up. You knew I made a wrong turn, and then now you're calling it out for the whole world to see.
Twice senior episode.
Super senior. It's like the second year of graduate school. How about that?
Sure. Anyway, we're still in New Orleans, and we are still on the run from the Saint of Killers, although surprisingly, I'm going to jump towards the end. I was not expecting Preacher to make a deal. But once he started to make a deal, I'm like, oh, he's going to take the deal. I don't understand why, though.
Why the killer?
Why the Saint of Killers took that deal? Yeah.
Well because he wants to. Because Preacher correctly assessed that Saint the Saint of Killers wants to end everything and go to heaven. He wants to get into heaven. He can't do it without a soul.
And he wants his family.
Yeah.
Well, I get that. I just didn't think he would trust the Preacher.
Well. I mean, look, on the great list of things that it requires a little bit of stretching to go with on this program, I'm going to say trusting Preacher is pretty low on the list. For me, there are two things that really stuck out is I absolutely loved the fact that they let you figure out in that opening vignette that the guy was buying souls or chunks of souls, fractional souls.
Yeah, no, I love
souls.
That a little bit.
I felt very.
Is he selling soul futures?
Pretty much. Okay. Oh, you haven't seen this one.
No,
yet.
I'm up to five. I haven't watched this.
Yeah.
One yet.
So it begins. It begins with somebody just running around doing transactions, and they're negotiating, and they're a price. You want a mortgage? 10%, 15%, or whatever. And they do a medical procedure, and they never go out of their way like he's selling pieces of souls. But instead, it becomes fairly clear, to the sophisticated viewer, like yours truly. But the other moment that really stuck out was how poignant it was with Cassidy revealing that Dennis is his son.
Like
that was surprisingly sweet, and
it was
that
very
actor,
sweet.
That actor really sold it for being a character that embodies chaos itself in Cassidy. For him to just full on feel completely, and to make me as a viewer feel along with him. I don't know. I'm getting a little choked up thinking about it. It was really sweet. It was really sweet.
All of Dennis's behavior make perfect sense. Why he would be so angry at Cassidy and yet let Cassidy do everything because he's his dad.
It's odd that this is totally that I remember not from the graphic novels. A whole other story. But aren't you? If you've read the graphic novels, like I've read them like 10 times.
Sure.
Aren't you just waiting for him to run into that other vampire
New
Orleans?
I've not read it.
Okay,
so but that's a great setup. Yeah, I'm excited.
Their New Orleans experience. Where he's like, there's one. I thought I was the only one, and he goes and he finds him, and the guy's like totally all interviewed with the vampire out, and he just stops and goes, "Oh, you're a complete wanker.
Yeah,
what a loser."
So, as somebody who's a fan of the comic books, are you happy with the changes as you've seen on the show?
I'm happy with the second season so far. I will say I was not terribly thrilled with that first season.
Really?
Was all a lead up to the actual story, and too much of it was just drama and not comedy.
Oh.
This season, they're like every episode has like a mix of really funny, of action, of just absurd. Last season, it was just so much lead up, and then by the end, you were like, well, what was the point of all that? Because 90% of these characters we're never going to see again.
As I am happy to report, as somebody who did not read the comics, I've read the very first episode, and that was it. Loved the first season. It was great, and I love the fact that if all that was just pushing the boulder over the edge of the hill in that first season, and now it's going to tumble and go crazy, I am very, very glad for that slow start to take me along for this ride.
I will say for other people, because there were definitely other people who like almost made me stop watching the first season. They hated it so much.
What?
And I'm like, if you felt that way, and I was disappointed with it too, really try the second season, because I think you're going to like it a lot more like I have been going, okay, this is more of what I wanted from Preacher.
All right. Well, anything else about Preacher before we move on?
No, it's great and continues to be
great.
But
read the trades. They're wonderful. It's one of the best comic books ever written.
I don't think I will. I think I'm going to wait until
the TV series is done. Then I'll read them.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
So I'd get more out of it.
I don't know if you noticed there was a Bill Hicks poster in episode
I did notice that.
Has actually makes an appearance in the comic book.
No kidding.
Yeah. Oh, I wonder if they're going to cast somebody to do that. That'd be kind of cool.
Alex Jones is available.
Please don't say that out loud. Don't give him money.
Is he available? Let's go to episode 3 of season 7 of Game of Thrones, where the first 20 minutes feel like 5 minutes, because at least to me, because it's the epic meeting of Daenerys and Jon Snow.
Yeah. Didn't go according to plan, did it? Not how you expected that to go. It was tense and measured and careful in a dance. And there's that moment you're like, oh, well, obviously the two are going to fall in love and come married and rule the... Oh, that's not what's happening at all.
Did I say that? I don't think I've ever said that.
Oh, no. That's me.
I was expecting a meet cute myself. I was just like, there'd be like, wow, it's like we've known each other forever.
That's exactly what I was expecting. It's just like, no, this is... I'm unyielding. Wait, you're unyielding? We can't both be unyielding.
Well, it's fun watching Daenerys, who is like so in every way the queen. She is just like, she is born for this, and Jon Snow is just like, what am I even doing here the whole time?
Well, it was so funny. The long title filled introduction of the Mother of Dragons, the Unburnt, the Queen of the Andals and the First Men, and then a kind of a quiet cough from Jon. Oh, he's Jon Snow. King of the North.
You can tell that this is not the Onion Knight's strength.
But
Tyrion is so great in this episode. I mean, like, oh my God.
Well, specifically, that quiet moment of the two of them on the side of that cliff, hearkening back to them on the side of the wall, the fact that in a world that will always see, you know, all dwarves are bastards, you know, like you felt the echoes of their, if not friendship, their mutual sincere respect for each other. And the fact that in this series, Tyrion is the first person that we see that has enough respect for Jon that he tells it like it is. He tells the truth. And now we see the inverse of that, where Jon is the one saying, like, I'm telling you the truth. The dead are walking, and I don't care what you say.
I'm a Tyrion Snow shipper now. That's all there is to it.
Snow shipper? Wait, what? A
Tyrion Snow shipper?
Wait, what is that?
Relationshipper?
Tyrion
shipper,
and, you know? Oh, and, got it, got it. Okay. I see. All right. It took me a second.
I thought you were internet savvy.
I thought he was like, they were going to row together in a ship or something.
That's how it starts. I'll give you that, Brian. My cognitive dissonance, because I was prepared for Jon not to bend the knee, and I was prepared for that to be Daenerys' problem. What I was not prepared for was me not knowing who to choose in this fight, because I'm used to Daenerys who's talking to the slavers, right? And I'm like, go Daenerys, give him what for. You're so strong and you know what you're doing. And I'm used to Jon Snow talking to the Night's Watch or the other bannermen in the North and being like, I'm just going to tell you guys what it is, you know, and you're going to follow me. And I'm cheering for Jon Snow. I couldn't cheer for either. I wanted them both to win, and they aren't winning. They're both holding strong.
I loved Sansa going, this is a bad idea. It's a terrible idea. Oh, you get to be boss. I'm with it. Let's do this.
That was a lovely little scene with Sansa going around, you know, noticing the things that need to be done, like leather on the breastplates and all that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Doggone it. Before we got to the big. I'll tell you what, man. Cersei, Jaime, and is it Euron?
Euron. Yeah.
That little pecking contest, I could watch a full season of that. Like, that is so tasty and salacious and amazing. Jamie, first of all, remarkable that Cersei is just like essentially announcing, hey, eat crap, world. I have sex with my brother. That's who's changed the bed sheets. Yeah. That's remarkable. And seeing him, like, Jamie is, I think we have more respect for him now in general, sum total, than at any point in the books up until then. But we could also see how flawed he is. He's just utterly blind. He's blindly in love with his sister. He's utterly powerless to say no to her.
Which they put into, if you'll excuse the pun, stark detail in the end of this episode, as he's just being flat out told in detail, look, you are blind. I get it. You're totally in love with your sister. Ooh, gross. But, like, you know, you're so blinded you can't see that she's Hitler.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And you don't have to be that guy. You could be better.
Which brings us to the utterly delicious and, I think, well-executed send off to Lady Olenna. Is that her name?
Oh, Lady Olenna.
Tyrell. Complete with like the switcheroo that they weren't even going to protect Casterly Rock. Like it was a double switcheroo. It was like, well, we got a sneaky way to take Casterly Rock. Also, it doesn't matter. They're not defending Casterly Rock. And then
And pointing out like this is what Robb Stark did to me. So we're learning from that strategy. And now in two episodes, it's gone from Daenerys has the overwhelming advantage to Daenerys is now at a disadvantage to the Lannisters.
A severe disadvantage, mind you. Like pretty much they took out the bulk of her allies. Now she still has three dragons, which as the show pointed out is like pretty much all the advantage you kind of need. And meanwhile, Cersei's like, well, but we have big crossbows, which I don't think is going to be enough. I predict one dragon gets taken out.
Here's what I think. I think one dragon probably does get taken out. I think it then is revived by the White Walkers to fight on their side.
Ooh.
And that crossbow actually has to be used on the White Walker with a bolt of dragon glass.
Yeah. By the way, real quick, side thing. I thought that the dragon glass compromise was a really good way to bring that butting of heads to a close, where it's like neither side got what they thought they were going to get, but it's a way for us to, for the two of them to be allies, quote unquote, and to be working together and both sides to claim some form of victory. I thought that was a good out on that.
My long-term theory here is that they're going to realize that they can't win through conventional means against the Lannisters. And what they're going to do is say, we're going to take advantage of the fact that Cersei absolutely doesn't believe in the White Walkers, and we're just going to funnel them through. We're just going to stand aside and let the White Walkers take care of that problem.
I don't know, man.
And then use our obsidian glass to take out the White Walkers.
I think there's something to that because Daenerys's resistance to Jon's idea has been, no, 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 I have to take King's Landing and I've got a plan for that. And then we'll worry about your grumpkins and imaginary friends.
Yeah.
But now she's on the run. In fact, it might even make sense to retreat north behind Jon's defense at this point, at which point the dragons could help take down the White Walkers. I also think that Nymeria probably has a troop of direwolves that can go up and fight on the side against the White Walkers. So I'm imagining we're going to get a crazy battle scene of direwolves and dragons and crows and wildlings.
I do get the strong sense. Do you remember that one episode that was entirely at the wall where it was just them fighting against the onslaught of it was the wildlings at the time, right? That felt as epic and huge as any Lord of the Rings movie. And I think we're looking, I mean, they know they're going to go out with the bang. I'm betting that they got a few million dollars budgeted just to make sure the last few episodes are as epic and as wonderful as any movie that you've seen.
Every episode of the last season is budgeted higher than any previous episode of the show.
I believe
they're all movie, and they're all going to be movie length. Like all of them are going to be like, I think the shortest is 88 minutes.
Wow.
So we're dealing with a pretty massive final season here. That's all going to be epic Lord of the Rings style craziness.
Two last set pieces, and both of which I enjoyed immensely. Number one, I enjoyed seeing Sam Tarly, get quote unquote busted for healing, and then not given the not reward of like go back to work. I enjoyed seeing a cured. Why can I not remember his name?
Sir Jorah.
Yeah. And then the other, like that whole scene with Cersei, allegedly murdering the daughter of the Sand Snake lady.
Presumably, actually.
I assume it's true, but also we don't actually see it. So I've learned not to trust anything.
I suspect we're going to see a scene quite a few episodes from now where the good guys bust into the dungeon and she's just sitting there looking at the shriveled corpse.
And it could be also would not put it past Cersei to do exactly everything she did and make a show of it just to torture them psychologically. Mm-hmm. Of like, well, you know it's coming. Your kids are going to die. And then, just come back and mess with her some other way.
The reason I think it's real is because they reuse in the same episode the same thing, the same potion, which you're like, well, why would Jamie not give her the actual poison?
Well, okay, but the one that I don't think it is the same poison because remember Jamie said this one would be painless, whereas it looked like the other one was pretty miserable.
That's true.
Well, and I thought that, going to that point, I thought that was a great scene in pushing Jamie towards this realization that I think he's going to have. I wouldn't be surprised if Jamie kills Cersei, because that's, you know, the thin line between love and hate, and he's coming right up against it. This is the guy who killed Aerys. This is the guy who pushed Bran out of a window.
Yeah.
And yet he tries to get a merciful death to Elena, who then explains to him afterwards why he shouldn't have given her a merciful death because of how she treated Joffrey.
She only taunts him from the safety, quote unquote, safety of the merciful death headed towards her. It's only like she jumps at that thing to drink, and it's like it's gone. And we're like, hey, by the way, let me tell you all the reason. Don't matter. I'm too dead. You can't torture me in time.
I picture the end. Cersei standing there torturing Jon Snow with Force lightning, and Jaime's standing next to her, kind of looking back and forth. And then he picks her up and throws her off the battlements.
He's more gold than mad now.
Also, someone else pointed this out in the chat, but I thought about this too, like how Cersei immediately, after kind of barely wiping the poison off her lips, starts mugging down with Jaime. He's like, what's that taste?
Yeah.
You'd think, right? You're like, I think I washed my face.
Yeah, whoops. regardless, man, still so good. So good. Yeah, and it really does, as we near the end, it makes me so hungry to want to go back and rewatch all of it straight through, because they have been so careful and so good about getting all their facts straight and building true world building in this.
Yeah, like I said last time, rewatching seasons 1 and 2, and I'm still going in 2, gives me a deeper appreciation for how they constructed this independent of the books. I'm fuzzier on the books than I was when I first watched season 1, and all the pieces are there. Not that they aren't complex, but they're there. And that's pretty crazy. It's pretty impressive.
Yep. Agree.
Let's move along to Firefly, where we watched the episode Bushwhacked. This is the one where they pull up alongside a cruiser or a colony ship rather, and get snagged by it, because it has been attacked by Reavers and booby trapped.
Yeah. Oh, man.
This is the classic, you know, horror on a spaceship, alien type, you know, we have an enemy, we don't know who it is.
So there's two realities. There's one reality in which, there's one reality in which we went straight from the pilot episode into Bushwhacked. And if that's the case, the pilot episode did a good job of showing us the long shadow of what the Reavers were, in which case follow it up with Bushwhacked and give us a very detailed, like, here's not only the long shadow of the Reavers, here's also the long shadow of the Alliance, here's their bureaucracy and all that stuff. In that version, I think I would be totally fine with going from one to the other and then moving on to the rest of the adventure. But in the other version of reality, the story begins with the train job. And then after the train job, which you have a brief appearance of the Reavers, and then they do a tricky switcheroo flyaway maneuver and they get away. So, and then you go straight into that. That's fine too. But in this weird hybrid reality where we watch the 2-hour pilot, then we watch this pilot 2.0 of the train job, and then we do Bushwhacked, which is like, by the way, Reavers are a real thing. I felt a little bit of fatigue just all around. Like, I already understand. The only thing this method of watching through that I feel like I really got out of this is a more clear understanding that the Alliance isn't necessarily evil. They're just bureaucratic. They're just space bureaucrats, and they're not interested in helping out the little guy or giving anyone freedom.
That seems accurate.
That's what they want you to think.
Okay. But I guess I'm ready to move to stories beyond the Reavers. And I already saw that the next episode, I think, is one of my favorites, with the Shindig episode as a standalone, is going to be really, really good. I'm very excited.
I don't have any of those problems that you have. But Bushwhacked is also still just in Firefly rankings, a middling episode.
Yeah.
And for me, it's because it's that tin can alien episode. It's like, okay, settle in. We're going to, you know, try to figure out who's really doing the killing. Is that, you know, this spaceship isn't as simple as it seems. And those are fairly predictable But they try to make them not be predictable and give you a twist and try to make you think, oh, it's not the survivor. Maybe there's a hidden reaver. Oh, wait a minute. It is the guy. And then he split his tongue. When you've seen it multiple times, as we have, that effect just don't work anymore. And so it's not the episode that wears very well.
It's a trope episode. It's one of the ones that almost every long running genre show has its version of this episode. As sure. Surely as if Firefly gone on another three seasons, we would have gotten a Groundhog's Day episode. Like yeah, every genre show has to have sure. Now by law. but it's elevated by the fact it has such good characters and such good dialogue, just like all Firefly. Yeah. It's a by the numbers one for genre television, but it's still better than most shows.
And there are moments where it really shines. I got to admit, much like Rick being just unnecessarily cruel in Rick and Morty, I enjoy them teasing the brother
Simon.
Yeah, Simon. Just getting them all freaked out, be like, "Get ready, man! You're gonna have to spacewalk
or the spacesuit on."
Yeah,
and it's like that would be enough. That would be funny enough. But then you have Kaylee like, "You had it on wrong." Like, yeah. You would have actually died if this had been real.
Well, and just how unnecessary it is that they keep giving him crap. It's like in The Office when, just this irrational hatred for Toby. Like, they just can't get enough of teasing Simon, which is great.
I would, too, have in that situation. I get it. You immediately want to make fun of him.
Agreed.
What a nerd.
Agreed.
By the way, what's the episode Christina Hendricks comes in? I always forget.
Oh, Saffron?
Man.
That's our Mrs. Reynolds. So we got Shindig safe and then that one.
Man, young Christina Hendricks in that episode changed my life. Holy crap.
That'd be great.
Anybody else just like, watching it with your girlfriend and quietly put a pillow over your lap?
Yeah. And
you're like, Mal, there's nothing you could do here that I would blame you for.
Dude, I'm looking at I got to stop looking at the upcoming episodes. I'm excited. Oh, hey, speaking of which, one thing that I'm surprised didn't make it into our tournament that you and I have both talked about wanting to watch, and I don't know that it fits into our archival episodes, but neither of us have seen Dirk Gently, and I've just continued to hear
amazing stuff.
I've been meaning to watch it.
It's wonderful.
Well, let's coordinate, make sure we both watch it at the same time.
Max Landis, who has gotten a lot of shit for everything he's done except for Chronicle, which is I still think quite good.
I think everything he's written has been fantastic.
I'm not judging it personally, I know a lot of people are very mixed about Landis's stuff. This is the best thing he's ever done, in my opinion. It's wonderful. And it's kind of a sequel, kind of a reboot, kind of a hard to say really where it takes place exactly compared to the books.
Right.
There is also a BBC series that is an adaptation of the books that came out like 5 years ago or so that's also worth seeing, but it's not as good as this is.
Right on. Yeah. Okay. Well, right. We'll good probably just jump right in with that.
Well, Chris Cox, thanks again for joining us. Remind folks about oneofus.net and where else they can go to find what you're doing online.
Yeah, we're a podcast network. You can find us on iTunes. I think we're on Stitcher or a couple different places. Or you can just go to the site itself where we review theatrical films. We review television shows. We do giveaways, as you can see from the image there. And it's group podcasts where we're trying to be funny like this type of thing. And I think y'all really like it. You should check it out.
Right on. Oneofus.net.
Go check it out. Thanks, everybody. We will spoil you again next week.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.